Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Lob Podcast with These Football Times, where it's magazine time again, with the focus shifting onto another English club, one that is seemingly very much on the rise again in Aston Villa. And luckily for us here at TFT Towers, we have ourselves our very own villain in the nicest possible sense of the word. Quite new to the TFT pods, but this is not his debut, if anyone's already heard him doing an us versus them with Stephen Scragg. So making his second appearance, I guess. A warm welcome to our latest signing, Mr. Ivan McDowell. Hi, Ivan. Great topic for you to get into today.
Thank you, Aidan. Yeah, really good to be here. As I've kind of alluded to, the idea that Villa are having a These Football Times magazine is a particularly kind of special moment for me. Having written about all sorts of other clubs and players and times, I guess this one is firmly where my heart lies.
Well, just wait till we send a copy to Prince Harry and Tom Hanks, and then we'll see how it takes off from there. Anyway, you're right, though. We had chatted briefly off air about writing a magazine about your own club. Obviously, I got that earlier this year with Newcastle United, and now yourself for Villa. It is an odd thing because usually we're doing these from a slightly distant perspective of additional research and learning as you go about some of the topics, as much as you pick and choose what you'd like to do. But there's always that extra element. Whereas when it's your own club, you know a lot of it. It kind of just comes from the heart a little bit. But also you get that extra pressure to do it justice, I suppose, as well, don't you? Because you know there'll be a lot of eyes on it that know you or know how to get in touch with you.
Yeah, absolutely. You've got to kind of make sure you're on point, haven't you, Aidan? You know.
This is true, but I have no doubt that you are on point, Ivan. So anyway, let's get into the magazine. All things Aston Villa. It will be out and available as you're listening to this, I expect, due for launch on the 19th of May. And as ever, it will be a veritable feast for the senses, with a host of stunning artwork, all with a claret and blue hue, no doubt, this time. The topics covered, I'll just run through the articles list. There are quite a number. So there's the earlier Victorian heroes, so from Villa's ridiculously successful time around the turn of the century, when they seem to win pretty much something every year, and sometimes more than one every year, as we will get into shortly. That's one of Ivan's pieces about the dim and distant past. There's also articles on Peter McParland, Charlie Aitken, Brian Little, both as player and manager. Then as we get a little more up to date, we've got the Ron Saunders era. Say up to date. God, that's a long, long time ago. That shows my age. Gordon Cowans. Then we got the 1982 European Cup success. And then we move on to Big Ron, Paul McGrath, Dwight York, Juan Pablo Angel, and then Martin O'Neill and his Barclays men, as it's been titled. And then we get into right up to date, Unai Emery's revolution that is bringing Aston Villa back to the top table again now. And equally, we have pieces on the Second City Derby and Villa Park itself. So that is a lot of articles to cover. We won't be chatting about them all today, but the magazine certainly covers them all in great depth. But we're going to focus on the pieces that Ivan and I have contributed to this magazine. Now, Ivan has got two, as you would expect, and be pleased to hear, I'm sure, when we're discussing Aston Villa. And the first of those, as I mentioned about the Victorian heroes, so this was a period in time where Aston Villa had a success beyond all others. And that is no exaggeration. You know, league titles in 1894, 96, 97, 99, 1900. You had to wait 10 whole years. I'm terrible. 1910 was their next one. Quite a few runners up in that time. It seemed to me if you didn't win, you were second. Five FA Cup wins in that era. 87, 95, 97, 1905, 1913. I think now the eagle-eared amongst people will note that 1897, I guess, is the most crucial year in that lot where Villa won the league and cup double. At a time where it was, well, I guess you were the second team to do it. I would imagine Preston a few years in front, but then it didn't happen again for an awful long time. So that that speaks volumes for that achievement. So, Ivan, the heroes of this time.
Yeah, it was genuinely a kind of golden age, I think is generally how it's described from a Villa perspective. And it's easy, isn't it, to almost be a bit dismissive of things that are so long past, but actually as, you know, a founder member of the Football League and a club that was absolutely kind of at the forefront of the development of football, you know, it's no surprise to see in some ways that all those league titles, you know, and FA Cup wins. And I think that really sort of rich status that probably sustains to this day, you know, certainly with Villa fans, but I think for fans of other clubs, was cemented in those early years of absolutely building, you know, what essentially those things that stand still in the record books, you know. And it was, an incredible time for what was initially quite a small kind of venture that started in Aston. And I mean, my article kind of focuses on certain kind of figures, I guess, in that period. I mean, the first one being George Ramsay. And George Ramsay, it's a fascinating story. Scotsman, which is partly why Villa have a lion on their badge. So he kind of brought that iconography with him. So when Villa played their 150th anniversary game earlier this season in the FA Cup, they wore a black shirt with a red lion, which is one of those early Villa kits that kind of Ramsay instigated. And it's a great story, Eddie. Like he apparently kind of came down from Scotland wandering through Aston Park and saw a group of young men playing football that turned out that it was the early iterations of Aston Villa Football Club. But actually his influence then, I think, by all accounts, he blew them away by kind of actually saying, oh, well, you know, why don't you try this? And actually began to cement that very early footballing style that would see Villa through that golden age and win them all of those titles. He was a player at first and captain of the side. And I think that, again, you know, he was very well respected very early on by his peers as someone that seemed to arrive in Birmingham with this kind of almost exotic knowledge of tactics and how to play football. But his legacy goes well beyond that. And he, it's something that kind of doesn't sit quite right with me. A lot of, you know, if you did a Google search on George Ramsay, it would probably throw up that he was the first football manager. But I think that probably in some ways doesn't do him justice, because he was almost like a director of football in essence. Because I guess, you know, football at that time was more about, you know, there was a trainer, there was someone that trained the side and so on. But actually the team was selected by a committee, of which Ramsay was one of a number of people. But I think his influence around the club and the initial stages of Villa played in Perry Bar before moving to what is now known as Villa Park. But he oversaw that kind of move into Villa Park and that idea of kind of building a club. And along with William McGregor, who obviously was the, you know, one of the founder members of the Football League, he always described it as Ramsay moulded the club's style of play. And I think that it's incredible sort of legacy almost to think of all those titles that you listed at the start, Aidan, that actually, you know, Ramsay drove that. So an incredibly important part of Villa's history.
I mean, that it's an incredible story. Just briefly reading little bits about him before this, well, of some of the people in the early teams for Aston Villa, to have chanced upon a career in professional football is quite astonishing. But to then become captain and everything else that followed on from beyond, and as you talked about, the legacy of the style of play is utterly remarkable. I mean, I guess the context of, well, I mean, this has probably gone a little bit beyond when the early days of some of the teams with their Scottish imports and so on, bringing the passing style. But obviously, the kick and rush, I guess, was still very much imprinted in a lot of English minds. It would be for an awful long time. still. And it's quite a remarkable tale that he brings to the club. And it's, you know, these are the kind of stories that I think the article pieces that we get to delve into shine a huge light on that, as you say, can easily be forgotten to the mists of time.
Well, I was just going to say, I think, and it's that because the passage of time is so great, you know, it's kind of almost a muddying of that legacy in some ways, you know. And I think if you walked around Villa Park, you know, this Friday when we're playing Spurs, things like that, you know, how many people would know who George Ramsey was? And I think that's, you know, that there's a responsibility on, obviously on the club, but also people that write about the club to kind of remind people of that. And I think it's sometimes hard, isn't it, to almost pin down that legacy. I mean, Ramsey's is buried in St. Mary's Church, which is in Handsworth, which is, you know, maybe kind of a mile away from Villa Park. And his headstone actually reads founder of Aston Villa, which obviously technically is not true, but actually in many ways what he brought to the club in those early years almost makes him the founder, if that makes sense.
No, absolutely. Founding the sort of spirit of it, I guess, or what it's led on to become, even in that era and then years since. No, absolutely. It makes total sense, even if it's not quite 100% accurate in the literal sense, but we don't need to dwell on that. I think I'm not going to make this pod about Newcastle, obviously, but I think there are some similarities between our clubs, different levels of success in the past, but harking back to a long, long way back for the strongest eras in our history, shall we say. And I think it can act as a burden, but it can also act as a big sense of pride. And I guess it's all so long ago that maybe it's not a burden anymore, but it's a source of pride that there was a time. You maybe look now and think, okay, well, we're on the up, things are looking good, but you never feel that you're going to have, you're not going to create a dynasty. You wouldn't expect, you know, you're not going to become dominant for a decade unless you have the wherewithal and resources of clubs bigger than either of ours, I guess. And so those moments of the past, the fact that you can then list off all these triumphs, all these league titles, all these FA Cups, winning the double long before any of these other super clubs did, it's got to be something that Aston Villa fans in the modern day cling to, I guess. Maybe that's not the right word, but take great pride in that this was their club. It's the same lineage. It's all followed on to what we see here today. It's all part of the one same organic whole, if you like, and it's a big source of pride.
And it's in the books, isn't it? You know, and I think that's important, isn't it? Is that, you know, when people, you know, whoever wins the FA Cup this year, you know, that they will be added to the books in the same way, but they will probably not have potentially won as many FA Cups as Aston Villa, for example, you know. And I think, well, Crystal Palace certainly won't have. But I think that, you know, I think it is that lineage. And I think it's really important that we remember that, you know, and celebrate that. And I think for Ramsey, he is that iconic figure that really began the trajectory that Villa then went on, because his influence, you know, once he'd stopped playing himself, it wasn't that then he disappeared. And I think actually that there then came a series of iconic players for Aston Villa that were absolutely moulded by Ramsey's influence, you know. And although he wasn't this idea of the trainer, you know, that kind of taking him through the paces on a park kind of thing, but the idea of actually how he moulded the club. And I mean, a great example is John Davy, who was probably, I guess, the first, you know, probably sort of supersedes Ramsey as a player. Was the captain, you know, won five league championships with Aston Villa. I mean, that's phenomenal. Two FA Cups, captained them to the double winning season, as you mentioned, 1896-97. You know, and a real kind of leader of men. And I, you know, when kind of looking into this history of Villa, you can sense Ramsey's influence in this. You know, the players that followed him were very much in his mould. And I think John Davies is a great example of that. And, you know, I mean, as I say, phenomenal numbers, isn't it, to win five league championships, you know?
Those were the days, eh? Those were the days.
He was also a cricketer as well, actually, which, you know, it always makes me laugh when you think about, you know, he was a batsman, I believe, for Warwickshire County Cricket Club. And you think, gosh, you know, so you've just, yeah, knocked off 7 trophies for Villa, and then in the summer you're down at, I guess, what is now Edgbaston, scoring runs. But, yeah.
Makes you sick, doesn't it? Makes you sick. But, I mean, it probably doesn't surprise me. You look at a picture of him, he looks very much the Edwardian gentleman with his big twirly moustache and lacquered hair. He's yeah, very elegant. But then I guess lots of them look similar. If you look at one of the team shots in those days, that's how they were. But no, I guess the fact that he looks like a gentleman, even if he wasn't, you know, so playing the cricket as well as the football makes some sense. Well, you mentioned iconic players there in that era, but obviously this magazine covers quite a few other iconic players too. You know, if I'm thinking of more relatively recent, Gordon Cowans, Paul McGrath, Dwight Yorke, Angell, and so on. But there's some from older eras too. But maybe if we focus on the more recent, are there any of those that resonate the most for you as a fan of Villa, as in cult hero status or particular favourites of yours that we've got covered in here? Or maybe, should I dare say it, ones that we haven't covered?
Yeah, but I think, I mean, it's a great selection. And, you know, and obviously, probably everything that's been said about Paul McGrath, you know, I can't better. So I think for me, you know, Dwight Yorke is a really iconic figure for Villa because of his longevity, you know, at the club. So Graham Taylor, you know, brought him in as a callow kind of youth from Trinidad and Tobago. And, you know, it's great. You hear Villa players. So Tony Daly was a future Villa winger at the time and tells stories about Dwight stood in a dustbin doing keepy-uppies on his head and, like, betting players that you couldn't do 100 and things like that. And he was absolute character around Villa. But for a long time couldn't really sort of cement a place in the side. And I think that a lot of managers didn't quite know where to play Dwight. So, I mean, my kind of early Villa days were really under Ron Atkinson. And we had, you know, Daly and Atkinson and Dean Saunders up front. And it was always a case with Dwight where he was kind of either covered for one of them or he'd play on the wing. And you never quite knew what you were going to get. But he always scored some crucial goals. You know, I remember a day in the Holt End, and we were playing Sheffield Wednesday in, I guess, 93, 94. And Dwight scored twice, and he was just electric. And a lot of Villa fans kind of craved kind of more of him, you know, I guess. But he was always in and out. But Brian Little, who obviously is also featured in the magazine, when he became manager, he really put a lot of stock in, right, Dwight, you're going to play through the middle, you're going to be my striker, and there we go. He absolutely took off. And I think from kind of 95, 96, when Villa won the League Cup, semi-final of the FA Cup and finished fourth. I mean, in modern money, that's a great season, isn't it? But I think, you know, and Dwight scored a lot of goals that season, really drove Villa forward. And it finally felt that someone, even though it was kind of 6 years on from him joining the club, was like, right, this is the player. This is who is going to be the fulcrum of our side. And I think it was, for me personally, it was great to see that kind of come to fruition. Although, obviously, a little bit of a sad end, I guess, for Dwight at Villa. And obviously, he decided, you know, perhaps correctly, that his opportunities to, I guess, win trophies were better elsewhere. And obviously, looked for a move and went to Manchester United, which I guess was vindicated for him because he won the treble. In 99.
Yeah, we'll give him that one, I suppose.
Although it does give us the best story ever about John Gregory, the manager at the time, who very famously, of course, was asked by a journalist, so, you know, when Dwight told you he wanted to go, what was your reaction? And John Gregory, with a straight face, said, if I'd have had a gun, I'd have shot him. So that is the story of Dwight Yorke at Aston Villa. But yeah, no, a wonderful, wonderful player and a great character, you know, was always a bit cliche, isn't it? But always, you know, seemed absolutely delighted until the very end to be putting on a Villa shirt.
That's the one thing that you recall most about Dwight Yorke, I find, is the joy he found in football. And it seems such an obvious thing, but many people don't have it. They lose that along the way somewhere. But he never seemed to. Maybe it's the relaxed nature of the Caribbean upbringing and things like that. I'm not sure, but he definitely had that sort of laid back enjoyment and exuberance of it all. He was a brilliant player, excellent striker. And of course that Villa team, I guess, of the early to mid 90s was a very strong side as well, wasn't it? Pushing, as you mentioned, quite high up in the table, rather successful cup glory, stopping Man United winning too many things early on as well, I think, weren't you? The one who got in their way, which is pleasing to everybody else.
Yeah, and it's interesting that, you know, York's departure almost signals a little bit of a decline then, really, is that we never really, you know, and it might be too easy a link to make in a sense, you know, one player leaving, but we, at the point he did leave, we then struggled to compete a little bit, and obviously certainly never won anything, but even in the league, you know, then Gregory ended up leaving, and, you know, there was a kind of a changing of the guard, I guess, including Juan Pablo Angel, who obviously is also featured in the magazine. Huge cult hero, had the absolute pleasure of meeting him on Friday night, actually, at an event. And it was probably 700 Villa fans there who just were absolutely enthralled to him, you know. And I mean, it's phenomenal. Isn't he, you know, I think he's nearly 50. I mean, you wouldn't think it. but, you know, he absolutely, you know, talking to Villa fans there of just the really kind of important status that Angel holds for Villa, in the sense that he was, you know, I would suggest the real kind of first kind of global player, you know. And I obviously, Dwight is an example of someone that wasn't English, but, you know, Juan Pablo was someone that came with, you know, a lot of interest from other clubs and really kind of took a while to get going, but actually then really cemented himself as, you know, and again, another, you know, to overuse the word, but iconic kind of Villa striker. Interestingly, at the same event, Dion Dublin was also there, and him and Angel played together for a time. And I think Dion was very gracious, but was very aware that perhaps Juan Pablo had superseded him in Villa fans' memories a little bit.
So you rate Juan Pablo Angel as a better import than Savo Milosevic, do you, eh?
Yeah, I mean, I love Savo. I mean, you know, I mean, Savo was that great. I'm sort of laughing, you know. I mean, he, you know, I guess let's start on something really important, that he, yeah, when we won the League Cup in 1996, he scored an absolute howitzer from outside the area, which I think is a really good memory. I mean, when we signed him, it was that kind of early days of, you know, I guess when you know, foreign players were still a little bit of a novelty, you know, or kind of cult heroes. You know, I always think of like Richard Sneakers at Bolton, people like that. And so Savo was that. It was like, well, what are we going to get? And I always remember he was unveiled at Villa Park, and he wore a bandana, and Doug Ellis, the chairman at the time, and obviously a huge part of the Villa story, kind of sort of sold this idea that he would be wearing a bandana when he played. And the Villa Village, which was the club shop at the time, obviously then started selling bandanas. And to no great surprise, Savo never wore a bandana when playing. So, yeah, it was a kind of, yeah. I mean, Savo will always have a place in Villa fans' hearts, I guess, because of that League Cup goal. But, you know, to be fair, Aidan, yeah, went on to arguably better things, you know, post-Villa. You know, scored a lot of goals in Spain, you know, and for the various iterations of Yugoslavia, Serbia in European competitions as well. So
yeah, we've all got these players who seem to just come to us at the maybe the right person at the wrong time or whatever it is, where you don't get the best from them and you see them jealously doing well elsewhere and it isn't quite right. But the iconic players you're talking about, and the York one in particular, and Angel, they sort of define whole eras, I think, don't they, of... It's not that they were key to everything that happened in those times, of course, but it's certain key characters you look back on, and it doesn't even have to be necessarily the striker or the best player or whatever. It's the ones that resonate most with people, and it can just be for odd moments. It can be for particular games and this, that, and the other. And they end up defining eras for you. Well, I guess if we're speaking of defining eras or particular times, well, let's go back to 1982 or 81, 82, Ivan. Now, and this is the one I wrote about. Now, my contribution is all about their finest hour, the 82 European Cup win. Well, I say finest hour. I guess that ranks above the double, does it? I don't know. What would you say?
I think so. I think so. I think that what beats winning the European Cup, I guess. You know, I guess, you know, George Ramsey and John David didn't have the opportunity to, I guess, would be the counter. But, you know, I think, did you enjoy writing about it?
Well, this is it. I really did. And it was a big education. I know I've come at it from the perspective of feeling that it's a triumph that isn't really given its due credit. And that's probably from people outside Aston Villa. You know, I'm sure Villa fans and those associated with the club probably never stop going on about it. But those beyond the club, I don't think it's given its credit. And no, I speak as someone who lived through this time. I was young, but I remember bits and pieces of Liverpool's wins and Nottingham Forest. Sketchily, I was very young then, but and Villa's was more recent than either of Forest's, and Liverpool obviously had several around that time, and then would have another couple of years on. But I do think that for the rest of us, and indeed English football in general, Villa's European Cup success—I hate to say—but it's almost like it's an afterthought of a very successful era of English football. Now, I don't mean that as any slight on Villa at all, but I think because it came at the end of a six-year run of English success, it's too easy to look back and just think, oh, well, that was just another one. They were the next man up, if you like, and therefore the win, not inevitable perhaps, but it was, you know, almost an expectation by that stage. I mean, that I'm sure that's not true, but it almost feels like it gets slightly forgotten as a result and not given the same credit, because Liverpool at that time won it three times before then and won a couple of years after. Forest had won it twice, whereas Villa won it once. Now, that shouldn't belittle it at all, but you're up against multiple winners there.
Naturally,
it comes as an after.
That's a big part of it, I think, is that, yeah, because, you know, that you know, dynasty, really, of Liverpool's wins and the fact that Forest did it twice, almost it's like, and also Villa won, you know, Villa won as well. You know?
Yeah. And that's exactly how it feels to me. So I do think had this win come at any other time or a few years later, Villa would have got more credit for it and they would be talked about far more as a European Cup winner. I think many modern fans might even forget the fact that Villa have won the European Cup. They probably do to Forest as well. But, you know, it's something that I think gets a little bit lost. And therefore, that's how I've approached this article. So it really was... I knew bits and pieces of it. I knew things about the final. I knew all about Nigel Spink and what had happened there for him, which is utterly remarkable. But that the whole story I didn't know too much about. But no, it was a really interesting one to get into and look at. And it was an incredible run, many good stories within it. And like I say, I didn't know that much about many of them before writing this piece. So yeah, I touch on Nigel Spink. Well, Jimmy Rimmer had been the goalkeeper, an excellent goalkeeper, and he'd been first choice for a number of years. Spink had been at the club for 3 or 4 years by this point, but had only played once in 1979. Prior to that, he'd just played for his local team, Chelmsford, I think, somewhere like that anyway. And he obviously spent most of his time playing in the Central League, the Reserves League, as it was at the time. So this, going into the European Cup final, he was on the bench. Now, that in itself was unusual too, because this is a time of only one substitute in English football, but in European games you could name five, so you could name a substitute keeper. So yes, the young Nigel Spink was on the bench, but obviously not expecting to come on. It would have to take a serious injury for that to happen. But Jimmy Rimmer had, of course, injured himself in training a few days before the final. They'd done everything they possibly could to try and get him ready for it, but only a few minutes in, He was unable to continue, and so Spink rushed to get ready off the bench. And probably just as well, he didn't have too much time to think it over, really. He was straight into the action and ended up performing utter heroics. He was phenomenal in this match, and this is, if it's just focusing on the final itself, the most remarkable story of European Cup glory from one player, I think, honestly. where he'd come from, the lack of experience, the circumstances, to then put in the performance, the saves he did against, this is Bayern Munich, so this is a great
Bayern side, let's not forget.
Well, exactly, and if we talk in those 6 years of English success, well, the three trophies prior to that were all won by Bayern Munich. They were European royalty. They had Karl-Heinz Rummenigge was their principal player at this time, obviously one of the finest players in the world. They were just off most of this team, or many of this team, off to the World Cup, where they'd be runners-up. The national team were European champions. Many of these players involved. This was a seriously, seriously strong team. But anyway, they were, I guess, naturally favourites for this game in the final, and they were attacking a lot. Let's say there was a lot of opportunities coming Bayern's way, but Villa were defending well, and when they did get through, Spink was there performing absolute heroics, like I say. And even when he wasn't, someone else cleared it off the line. But you can add in to this season as well, beyond what happened in the final, there's the drama of Ron Saunders' departure as well, which must have come as an absolute bolt out of the blue in the February, I think, of 82, just prior to the quarterfinal. The impact that could have had on this campaign, Ron Saunders, has a separate article all about him, but essentially over the previous 8 or so years, he'd led Villa from the lower reaches of the second division up to competing in Europe regularly, having won the League Cup twice, and then on to obviously winning the league title in 1981 with a famously small group of players.
Just 14.
You won't see the likes of that again. But then for him to depart with financial wranglings, I think, is the principal reason behind all of that. That really could have thrown a major spanner in the works. I guess in terms of league form, Villa weren't having quite as good a year this time. But in Europe, the success was just continuing. So that was quite a dramatic situation. Tony Barton, who'd been a scout, I think up at this point, took over on an interim basis. Before the end of the season, he was made permanent because it was going so well. And he is obviously the one who officially led Villa to European glory then. Yeah, the campaign also took Villa to East Berlin, took them to the Crimea to play Dynamo Kiev because it was still frozen. This was the quarterfinal, I think, and it was too cold in Kiev. So they had to go to Crimea for that. Incredible performances from the names reel off the tongue. Jimmy Rimmer I've mentioned, but there's Tony Mortimer, Gordon Cowans, Gary Shaw, Tony Morley, and so on. You know, these are players that the names just are synonymous with that time and a great team. There was Anderlecht in the semi-final. There was all sorts of, well, bad situations, shall we say. Probably not the Villa fans' finest hour, but that equally speaks of the time as well, doesn't it?
And I think that the club were quite worried about what was going to potentially be the result of that for the final. And in fact, although the punishment, if you like, was delayed slightly because the season after they won it, when they were defending it, their first game was behind closed doors as a belated punishment. But they are such, you know, when you reel off those names, when I was talking to Stephen on the TFT Us versus Them, his kind of guilty pleasure about Villa was Tony Morley and Gary Shaw and just those, you know, the long sleeve shirts over their cuffs, you know, and just like wonderful players. And I think, you know, obviously Gary Shaw's death this year is, you know, sort of rang, you know, it's obviously really, you know, salient for Villa fans, but I think kind of rippled out into the football community because he was just something very different, wasn't he?
Oh, and his flapping blonde locks made him stand out as well in addition to his skills and attributes. But yeah, you're right. His death, I guess, ironically, has brought this European Cup win and the league title win back into the attention a little more, back into the consciousness, as has the current team's efforts in the Champions League, of course, which has brought that back, especially when you played Bayern Munich. Also, but yeah, there were some superb performances in this final, Spink most notably. But the winning goal, obviously Spink didn't play a part in that. He was the match-winning hero, though, I would say, even if the goal was scored by Peter Wyth, someone who also played at my club, but not quite as famously. Fine work from Morley on the wing, firing the ball across. And Well, Peter Withe described it as coming off his shin and his ankle. It bobbled up just before him. So it wasn't the most salubrious of European Cup winning goals, I suppose, but iconic in its own way. I was interested to see, he notes that if the ball hadn't bobbled and he hit it truer, it probably would have been saved in his mind. I don't know what the truth of that
is. Oh, yeah. But who cares? You know?
Who cares?
That iconic the commentary is still, you know, still adorned on Villa Park. You know, Williams down the left, feeds Morley. Surely it must be. It is, Peter Withe, yeah. You know, we're talking about moments that forever will be part of Villa's history and European Cup history, you know. A wonderful moment, and I'm sure was really great to write about.
Oh, it was. And I went quite long on it, I have to say. So that's one to spend a bit of time reading. It was definitely an education for me, but it's an achievement I think Villa deserve greater credit for, frankly. So let's hope this goes a little way to helping that. I think Peter Withe too, if we're talking about heroes at this time, he's got an interesting European Cup story, of course, because he was with Forest prior to their triumphs, and his own demands of pay or contract or whatever caused him to have to leave. And that's when he went to Newcastle, who were second division. And that was quite a step down from where he was, and he had to watch on from there while his mates at Forest went and won the thing twice. So for him to get the opportunity to right that wrong in some ways at Villa, to score the winning goal, was fabulous. I always find him he has an iconic look, I think, with the two sweatbands and the stubble and all of this. He looks very, very iconic. And I think for the chance to fall to him, it just it adds to the imagery of it.
It's interesting, isn't it, how that kind of that trajectory of players kind of, the example of Withe being at Forest. Because I think there's kind of a Villa example with Andy Gray, who was, you know, absolutely Ron Saunders's kind of go-to guy, and then, you know, bit of a kind of falling out, essentially. And, you know, in many ways, because he was such a young man when he was at Villa, like really probably in some ways could have been that striker in that European Cup final. But I guess it's the way it unfolds is interesting.
Well, it is. We had a chat, Paul McPollen and I, for a pod a few years back with Andy Gray, talked a bit about his feelings on that, and how he's got no love for Ron Saunders for the way things panned out. But obviously it was different while they were successful together, of course. And well, his view obviously was that he went on to a strong Everton team and got his glory there, but he never managed quite this glory, did he? So, you know, you do have to wonder the true feelings on that. And like I say, we have another article dedicated purely to Ron Saunders' time in charge. What I think adds to his story of this departure, though, is where he pitched up at Birmingham City, of all places. And the first win of Tony Barton's reign was against Ron Saunders' Birmingham City. I mean, that
in its first story, win, at least.
It's magnificent.
But I think it kind of sums Ron up, that he was just, He didn't see this as an issue. You know, he was a football man, but he was, well, they don't want me, so they do. Here we go, you know. And yeah, he was a very principled guy, as I'm sure Andy Gray would echo, in maybe not a positive way, but he was, you know, he was a very, you know, and I mean, that the famous quote that is often used from his, you know, when asked about, you know, do you want to bet against us, you know, and he had a very steadfast, forthright idea of how he wanted to play football, how he wanted to manage a club, what his role was. And, you know, the minute that didn't fit with him and Villa, then, you know, he made no hesitation in drawing a line under it, which is sad in some ways, you know. But he, you know, I mean, you know, Tony Barton was obviously a really important part in kind of bringing the European Cup home. But, you know, Ron Saunders' influence over that time, you know, ultimately kind of built the potential for us to be winning the European Cup. So, you know, deserves
you. No, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, this is what I was going to ask you, really, as a Villa fan, what are your thoughts on Ron Saunders as a whole? And obviously a hugely successful time, but is his reputation intact, I guess, or was it tarnished by the way it ended?
Yeah, I think for me and probably the majority of the fans, it's absolutely intact, because I don't think it was, whilst it wasn't ideal. I mean, well, you know, obviously it predates me, but you know, my understanding of the time is that it wasn't ideal. You know, and Villa fans were shocked and, you know, kind of a little bit bereft at the idea that someone that had taken us from a really kind of lowly position to, you know, winning league cups, winning the league championship, and challenging on the continent, was willing to walk away. So I think maybe at the time there was a rawness, but I think, you know, time is equally a great healer, isn't it? And I think that actually when Villa fans look back now, that is, you know, he is, you know, probably, possibly, and you know, until we start comparing with our current manager, maybe the, you know, the, I keep using the word, Aidan, sorry, but you know, the iconic Villa manager, you know, because I think that, you know, I certainly wouldn't want to do down Tony Barton in any way, but it was Ron Saunders's side, you know, and it was that, you know, it wasn't that Tony came in and particularly altered anything, you know. I mean, he took the reins very, very successfully of a wonderfully kind of embedded side and a group of players that absolutely knew their jobs and played a certain way. And, you know, so I think, you know, I think that's why maybe Ron Saunders is still held in utmost regard in Villa circles.
No, that's good to know. I think, I mean, it's and quite right too, really, because as you rightly say, this was his team. He'd built it for the best part of a decade up to this point. So yeah, absolutely. He deserves some of the credit, a lot of the credit for the European Cup win, even if he was no longer there at the sharp end of the tournament, which I guess from a neat narrative perspective is a shame, but equally it does add a really interesting level of intrigue to the whole thing. Yeah. And makes Tony Barton into quite a hero as well of the day. So unlikely heroes in Spink and Barton, perhaps.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a proper fairy tale story, isn't it? You know, the goalkeeper coming off the bench and making wonderful saves in a game that, like you're saying, if it was a league game, he wouldn't have even been on the bench, you know. And then, you know, for Barton to be that almost caretaker, but, you know, not in essence, but I think it's kind of fairy tale. I always enjoy the story about the fact that the ITV kind of, I guess, pundit touchline reporter Gary Newbon was also sat on the bench next to Nigel Spink and had to say to Nigel Spink, "Oh, I think you're going to come on, Nigel, because Jimmy's not looking too great, you know." So, yeah, a different age.
It really is. It really is. And I guess for Spink too, I mean, he went on to have a lengthy, very good career, but you're never going to top this moment.
You can't. Like, yeah.
No matter what you do. It's got to be an odd thing for your second professional game to know is literally all downhill from here, no matter what you do.
Yeah, and you think, like, actually, I mean, although he, you know, so that, I mean, we're talking to 82, he lifts the European Cup. He did win a promotion in 1988, but it's then until we won the League Cup in 1994 when he was only on the bench because Mark Bosnich had displaced him. So we're talking, you know, 12 years before you kind of even, yeah. But he's, you know, I mean, he talks very well about it now, and what a wonderful moment for a young man, and again, another a true Villa legend, you know.
Well, let's be honest, to have that as the first point of your career and everything else can't live up to it is better than never having it at all. And that's what the majority of players would have. So, you know, it's a magnificent story. But anyway, we'll bring us up to modern times. So, Ivan, you've also been writing, or are still trying to finish off as we speak, your second piece, which is on Unai Emery and the modern revolution of Aston Villa. So, I mean, Villa are back at the top table, a superb Champions League campaign this season, knocking on the door, shall we say, of qualifying again this time around. It's safe to say Emery has been a huge success at Villa already, helping them to compete in and around those in the top few places. I'll drift off into Newcastle momentarily again here. Purely in football terms, if we ignore the elephant in the room of certain ownerships and so on, both Newcastle and Villa have mixed things up a little bit differently, I guess, and Forest too at the top end of the table recent seasons in amongst the big six, shall we call them, which includes the 16th and 17th teams in the Premier League. Although I suspect the Forest bit is probably less likely to last as it might be for Newcastle and Villa. There's a real push, I guess, to try and become part of the leading lights. I guess time will tell how that goes. It's hard to do so in the current climate. Whereas what is clear, though, is under Emery's leadership, the club's reached heights that it hadn't done for some time. And it seems far more likely to be sustained. There's been little peaks and whatever over the last couple of decades, but nothing sustained. But equally, what I find really interesting too, and again, the parallels to Newcastle, I think are clear. You know, we're not many years on from Villa being relegated and having to fight their way back out the Championship. A significant turnaround in recent times. Not all under Emery, of course, but he's pushed them on to the biggest heights that they've reached recently. Equally, it's well known that he was the Newcastle owner's first choice for manager ahead of Eddie Howe, and he very nearly joined us. The timing wasn't right then, and he had his loyalties to where he was at that time. But that Newcastle's loss in that sense, even though we're quite happy with what we ended up with, has been Aston Villa's gain. He's pushed Villa on, developing a really hugely exciting team, bringing in some excellent players as well, and hugely exciting times for Villa, Ivan. So your thoughts on Emery and current
fans? Yeah, I mean, Unai, gosh. I mean, he's transformed the club, Aidan. That's you know, I don't mean to, you know, make grand statements, but I genuinely believe that. You know, and our trajectory is, as a side, you know, you're right, obviously relegation to the Championship and three, you know, kind of long years in the second tier. You know, huge credit to Dean Smith for really understanding the culture of the club to kind of get us back to a point where we obviously came up in the playoffs and then survived in our first season, so after Project Restart. But what Emery has brought is something more than that, because when you look at the side now, there are players that played in the Championship for Aston Villa in that side. And I think that, if I was to distill sort of an Emery influence, that's part of it. You know, so, you know, when you think of, for example, our first, you know, that first season back in the Premier League, you know, the likes of Ezri Konsa, Tyrone Mings, John McGinn, you know, these are players that had come up, well, Konsa joined that summer, but could largely come up from the Championship and are still there now. And they're not just hanging around the periphery. You know, is that, you know, Mings, Conjure and McGinn all started, you know, in our last league game when we beat Bournemouth. So what Emery has done, I think he's made those players even better than they were. And I think, you know, we've seen that with the likes of Youri Tielemans this season, Douglas Luiz the season before. You know, yes, obviously talented footballers, but that idea of working with Emery and him bringing those talents to the fore, I think is unique. So I think, you know, a lot of those Villa players, I'm sure, would say that he is the, you know, the best manager they've ever worked for. I also think he innately, he gets the club, which, you know, is partly about Villa, but it's partly about him. You know, as part of my article on him, I've been sort of doing a bit of reading about his own trajectory. And I think he's always been really clear on this idea of the importance of the relationship between the team and the fans and understanding the history of the club. And I think that is absolutely how he's kind of driven his Aston Villa forward. And I'm sure if, you know, don't get me wrong, I'm sure if he'd have ended up in your neck of the woods in Newcastle, he would have done the same, because I think it's,
oh, absolutely,
it's about his personality, you know. It's about what he wants. And he talks all the time about this idea of the connection that the team must have with the fans. And he's given, you know, even as a, you know, someone who's been watching Aston Villa since the dog days of the 1980s, you know, he's given me and my son some of our finest moments, you know. And that's not just the Champions League. You know, that was getting to the Conference League and him coming in and, you know, the dark days of November 2022 under Steven Gerrard, and you know, the long walk across Craven Cottage and sort of Gerrard's last stand, to coming in and in that first season, you know, finishing seventh and qualifying for the Conference League. And, you know, a generation of Villa fans hadn't seen us in Europe, you know, and I think that, like, we shouldn't underestimate that. And, you know, when you see, you know, the Nottingham Forest owner on the pitch shouting about potentially missing out on this and that, you know, I think everyone needs to remember that is these clubs, you know, despite our past glories, you know, we are maybe at a point where you kind of need those early interventions. And Unai brought that to Villa, you know, and we had a wonderful adventure in the Conference League, which then obviously he built on fourth place Champions League campaign this year. And wherever we end, wherever Villa end up this season, it should still be absolutely seen as a success, because three seasons in European competition, it's a long time since Aston Villa Football Club did that.
Oh, absolutely. And what you said about him getting the club, I think that's such an important factor. He's obviously an elite manager. He's an excellent manager. His time at Arsenal didn't... It's good that that didn't tarnish his reputation as an excellent manager, because... It wasn't quite that bad, was it?
It wasn't that bad,
but still he was sort of hounded out there. He wasn't given his due credit, really, and he's gone on to show what a superb manager he is.
It always frustrates me a little bit, though, because you think, like, gosh, you know, I mean, didn't he get him to a Europa League final? Story for another day, perhaps. But.
Levels of expectation and entitlement, perhaps, dare we say. but no, he is an elite. He's a superb manager. I mean, even, I know you talked a lot about the players that have been there some time, but even on the temporary basis of somebody like Rashford, to have suddenly taken someone who was out of favour, apparently having behavioural or temperamental issues or whatever, and to get excellent use out of him, get him to contribute well, even in that short space of time. Just little things like that show that he's got good manner management. He's got he knows how to get the best out of people that others seemingly can't or fail to do, as well as getting the club, getting the fans. I think that is such an important element, and people often misconstrue that you have to have some sort of connection to be able to do that, and that's just utterly wrong. You just have to be of the right type of character and to take the time to understand a club, its people, its history, and what makes it tick. And those that do that, aside from putting themselves in a very strong position to succeed, which obviously he has done, they also get, I don't know, a greater sense of loyalty, I guess, from the fan base as well, because there's that level of sort of mutual understanding rather than just simply the footballing side. And I think that goes a long, long way. It's like less tangible, I guess, and maybe more touchy-feely than proper football men and all of that. But I think it's a very important factor, especially in the modern game, where things can feel a lot more out of touch at times. And I think that sort of brings it back, which is good to see. Moving us along, we've covered quite a bit of what's in the magazine for our areas. One thing I would like to touch on, because there is an article on the Second City Derby, you know, this obviously hasn't happened for some time, shall we say. But how do you feel about Birmingham City's potential resurrection? Now, they're up from the depths of League One now, aren't they? Celebrity ownership and all that comes with that. But really, I guess we're talking, is there the potential, if they were to return to the top flight, would you welcome that? And would you welcome the return of the Birmingham Derby? Or is that a prospect that just fills you with dread because it's got banana skin written all over it?
Well, I think I'm probably inclined the latter. I mean, in the FA Cup this year, my son, who's 13, said to me, "Oh, Dad, I hope we draw the Blues so we can you know, show them who's who." And I said to him, "That's a dangerous thing to wish for."
Oh, I tell you, last season we drew Sunderland away in the FA Cup.
Yes, yeah.
This is when they were, you know, mid-table championship at this point. And it was awful. As much as it went okay, it was just, all it could do was go okay or go horribly wrong.
Yeah, well,
you're not going to gain.
Disaster is just too much, you know. As much as I have some great memories of derbies, you know, Alan Hutton running through their whole team to to plant a ball in the net against in the whole end was one of them. But equally, I remember the ball going under Peter Enkelman's feet at St Andrews, you know. So yeah, I mean, I think firstly, yeah, I don't have any great antipathy towards Blues, you know. In essence, you know, in my supporting life, my view would be that we've always been the kind of stronger team. You know, I think they would cite certain years of maybe that's not the case, but you know, that I don't feel that it's ever been a particularly, for me personally, a kind of a vociferous kind of relationship. I think they need to keep their ideas a little bit in check, you know. And I mean, they've obviously done really well to, you know, win League One and finish runners up in the Auto Windscreens Trophy or whatever it was. But ultimately, I think the Championship's going to be a real test for them. You know, the same way that teams coming up from the Championships to the Premier League, they've essentially built a squad for the Championship already in League One. So I don't think, you know, I think they're going to be, you know, a bit more governed by sort of some financial fair play rules in the Championship. Would I like to play them all the time? You know, probably, because they're kind of great games. It's great to have a game. You know, it's great to have a derby, isn't it? You know, and I think they're important for the culture of our football clubs. But my sneaking suspicion, Aidan, is that it won't be happening quite as soon as they think it will be.
Well, okay, excellent. Well, that is recorded for posterity, Ivan. So, yeah, exactly. This can be revisited in a year's time when they run away with the Championship. We shall see. We shall see. But yeah, you're right. I have similar thoughts on Sunderland, who are, as we speak, ahead in their playoff semi-final tie. I mean, by the time this is out, who knows how that'll have panned out. But I at work, I have several Sunderland sympathising colleagues, and they're even in two minds of whether they even want to come up yet. And I think it's probably similar for Birmingham City, because at this stage, you need to build a little more. If we look at how the promoted teams have struggled in recent years, the difference is getting so huge.
Well, it is, isn't it? I mean, I've got a good friend who's a Leeds fan, and you know, and he said to me, "So I think we'll stay up." I said, "Well, you might." I said, "But if you stay up, who's going down?" And that is an incredibly hard question at the moment, I would suggest, because there's that gap is, when you think that United and Spurs are the two.
Yes, the gap between the bottom three and Spurs and Man United. Anyway. Will they close that gap on that two of the big six? Anyway, enough about them. We're on about the new elite of Aston Villa on this occasion. So the magazine, that was just a flavour, I guess, of what is coming in this magazine. A huge number of articles. Like I say, it'll have excellent artwork. It will even smell glorious. That I can promise you as well. This should be out on the 19th of May, and as ever, it will sell fast. So if you want to get a copy, make sure you get in there quickly. Before we wrap up, a final question for you. Well, a final couple of questions. Why not? Which other article would you be heading for first in this magazine, aside from your own?
I think for me, the Peter McParland article. I'm really interested. I mean, obviously, you know, recently passed away, the last surviving member of our last FA Cup winning team. I'm really interested to kind of get a bit more insight into what I expect is a story about not only his kind of Villa influence, but, you know, Northern Ireland's top scorer at World Cups, that sort of thing, the first Villa player ever to play at a World Cup finals. So, yeah, I think I'm really interested to read that one.
Oh, fabulous. And finally, then, what does the immediate future hold for Villa?
Well, I guess at the time of recording, another season in Europe, I think, which is a great thing. You know, I think if someone had offered me European football for 3 years in a row, great. And I feel like we are in a position to challenge on all fronts, which we haven't been for quite some time. I'd love Aston Villa to win a trophy. You know, I'm very much in the camp of seeing something with claret and blue ribbons on it and John McGinn potentially lifting it is, you know, that again, one for the books, as opposed to kind of finishing fourth, fifth and things like that. But I think we've got a good balance at the moment between that idea of pursuing winning something with also the long term success of the club, which inevitably now focuses on, you know, competing in European competitions. So yeah, the future is bright.
Future is bright. It's Claritin Blue, apparently. Excellent. There we go. Well, thank you very much, Ivan. Great chat. And hopefully everybody, once they get their hands on this Aston Villa magazine, enjoy it as much as we've enjoyed writing and talking about it. So thank you for listening. And do join us again next time on the Lob Podcast with these Football Times. Thank you. And bye.
Many thanks for joining us today on the Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists, and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.